From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, bassist Charlie Hayden. With his group Quartet West, Hayden has paid tribute to film noir and detective novels. Their newest album salutes the art of the song and features the singing of Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson and Hayden himself. And we meet Josh Hayden, a bassist like his father, who's gone from punk to slow and moody music with his trio Spain. They have a new CD. Also, we remember jazz trumpeter and flugelhornist Art Farmer. He died on Monday. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has overwhelmingly approved a measure designed to protect patients in managed care health insurance plans. President Clinton called it a major victory for consumers.
It says you have the right to the nearest emergency room care and the right to see a specialist. It says you have the right to know you can't be forced to switch doctors in the middle of a cancer treatment or a period of pregnancy.
And it gives patients the right to sue their HMOs in state court if they're denied treatment. The measure must still be reconciled with a less far-reaching bill passed by the Senate. The bill won the support of nearly all the House Democrats and 68 Republicans. President Clinton is in New York City today raising money for Democratic candidates and meeting with James Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton's remarks tonight at a labor dinner honoring Hoffa will be the first time in decades that an American president has appeared in public with the Teamsters. The union has been under federal supervision for a decade because of corruption. But today the president admitted he would like Hoffa to change his opposition to an early union movement endorsement of Vice President Al Gore.
That is not the purpose of my going there. They invited me to come by and I was happy to accept. But I have already had a meeting with the executive committee, with all the executive committee of the AFL-CIO, in which we have discussed that issue, among others.
The AFL-CIO meets next week to decide whether to give Gore an early endorsement or to wait. Gore's opponent for the nomination, Bill Bradley, has been lobbying the AFL to postpone an endorsement. Mara Liasson, NPR News, with the president in New York.
German companies and the German government have offered $3.3 billion in compensation to people who worked as slave laborers and as forced laborers during the Nazi era, and to others who lost property. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Those seeking compensation include Jews and non-Jews, largely from Central and Eastern Europe. A 250,000 worked under slave-like conditions, barely surviving the ordeal. At least 500,000 were forced laborers, faring slightly better. Their representatives rejected the $3.3 billion proposal at talks just held in Washington. German negotiators called it their final offer. The U.S. mediator, Deputy Treasury Secretary Stuart Eisenstadt, said it's good that both sides plan to meet again.
But it's also clear that there'll be no agreement unless both sides show increased and added flexibility.
If a deal is reached, it would protect German companies from future lawsuits arising from this issue. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 51 points to close at 10,537 in active trading. This is NPR News. Jim Hall, the chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, told a House panel today that cruise ships should be required to carry data recorders, much like the black boxes that are now carried by commercial airliners. Hall said flight data recorders have made aviation safer and could help investigators who are studying cruise ship disasters. Hall also said cruise ships should be required to have the same standard of smoke detectors and fire alarms that are now required for U.S. hotels and motels. The Federal Reserve reported that consumers added almost $11 billion of debt in August, the biggest increase in 7 months. NPR's Snigdha Prakash reports.
It's not news that American consumers are on a shopping spree. Still, economists were taken aback by just how much consumers borrowed in August. They had estimated consumer debt would grow by about $6.5 billion. They were off by a little over $4 billion. Consumer borrowing rose strongly in July as well, by about $9 billion. This number doesn't include mortgage debt. It's mainly car loans and credit card loans. Economists say one reason it's going up so rapidly now is that many Americans have run out of the home equity they cashed when they refinanced their mortgages last year and early this year when mortgage rates were very low. It's one more sign that consumers are feeling bullish, and if they don't have the money, they'll go out and borrow to spend. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
New York real estate developer Donald Trump has formed an exploratory committee to help him decide whether to seek the Reform Party nomination for president. Trump is scheduled to meet this evening with Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, the Reform Party's top elected official. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Before we sent Terry home to get over her cold, she had a chance to record an interview with Charlie Hayden, one of the greatest living jazz bass players. Hayden helped change the shape of jazz in the late 50s and early 60s as a member of the original Ornette Coleman Quartet. In 1969, he launched his own group, the Liberation Music Orchestra, whose music was inspired by democracy movements around the world. In 86, he founded his group Quartet West, whose sound pays tribute to film noir, detective novels, and jazz and pop singers of the 40s and 50s. The new Quartet West album is a collection of classic but seldom performed songs, featuring singers Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson. The quartet's pianist, Alan Broadbent, arranged and conducted the chamber orchestra, and Charlie Hayden makes his recorded vocal debut. The CD is called The Art of the Song.
Charlie Hayden, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Why did you want to do an album of songs?
I wanted to do an album of what I call art songs that are lasting melodies with beautiful chord structures that not very many people have recorded. And when I started thinking about doing this record, I got these special songs that I wanted to hear Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson sing.
Let me play a track from the CD, and this is one that features Bill Henderson singing. And the song is You, My Love. And it's from a Frank Sinatra film called Young at Heart. It stars Sinatra and Doris Day. And he plays this alienated composer who earns a living singing and playing at bars where people don't appreciate him. And he's writing the song through the whole movie, but he's blocked by his own self-doubt and by his inferiority complex. And at the end of the movie, he finally completes the song and sings it. I've never heard anybody do this song, You, My Love, outside of the movie. Why did you decide to feature it on your CD?
I saw this movie when I was, just out of high school, and I love this song. I've always got music running through my head while I go about my daily work, and this song has never left me. And I pictured Bill Henderson singing it. You know, and Bill Henderson was friends with Frank Sinatra. Frank really loved the way Bill sang, and Bill told me stories about when he was in Vegas in the 60s. And Frank Sinatra was at the Sands, and he was at the Sands, and Frank kind of took him under his wing and introduced him to a lot of people and really loved the way Bill Henderson sang.
Well, let's hear Bill Henderson singing the song originated by Frank Sinatra. The music is by Jimmy Van Heusen and the lyric by Matt Gordon, and this is an excerpt of the track from Charlie Hayden's new CD.
My love is ever you, my love. Now and forever, you, my love. You walked into my lonely world . What peace of mind
your smile unfurl. Yes, and because of you, my love, my wishful dreams came true, my love. In my uncertain heart, I am only certain of how much I love you, my love.
That's Bill Henderson singing You, My Love from Charlie Hayden's new CD. Although your new CD is called The Art of the Song, there are a couple of things you sneak in here that aren't songs. For example, I want to play something from a Rachmaninoff symphony, and this is a Moment Musical Opus 16, number 3 in B minor. Let's start with why this piece means a lot to you and you wanted to include it.
Rachmaninoff has always been one of my favorite composers. I wish I could have met him and talked to him and asked him all kinds of questions. And he wrote these slow movements that were just the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard. And he wrote these series of piano pieces called Musical Moments. And this was just one of them. Actually, it's one of my favorite ones. And I always pictured it being played by a chamber orchestra. And one day when Alan Broadbent was at my house and we were discussing the arrangements, I said, I want to play this for you, you know. And I played it for him, and Alan is very aware classically. He was classically trained. He knows all classical music. And he had never heard this particular piece before, and he really loved it. And I said, would you like to just arrange this for orchestra, chamber orchestra, exactly the way it's written for piano? He said, I'd really love to. So that's why this came about.
Well, let's hear it. And this is from Charlie Hayden's new CD, The Art of the Song. That's an excerpt of a piece by Rachmaninoff as arranged by Alan Broadbent for Charlie Hayden's new CD, The Art of the Song. That's really quite nice. I love the walking bass line that you're doing underneath that. And I was wondering if there was anything comparable happening in the left hand in the original Rachmaninoff piano piece.
Well, actually, that wasn't me that were...
It wasn't you.
That was two bass players that were in the orchestra.
Huh.
The orchestra consisted of 30 strings, violins, first violins, second violins, violas, cellos, and two bass players. And one of the bass players is the first chair bassist in the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
Huh.
And And I was very glad that they were there and reading all that music. And I was reading music too, but I was reading the other music. And on this particular piece, I only played these little interludes that the piano plays. You can hear when I come in pizzicato. But that was done in the classical piano piece with the left hand playing the bass.
So it was the same kind of line?
It was the exact, this is the exact piano, the way the piece is written for piano. This is exactly the way it is written, only just done for orchestra.
Did you spend much time talking with the classical, was it cello or bass doing that walking line?
That was the bass players.
Yeah. Did you spend time talking to them and kind of comparing notes about your approaches to your instrument? Did you find that they had a different kind of sound or a different concept behind it?
Well, whenever bass players get together, especially classical players and jazz players, they always exchange notes and look at each other's basses, you know. And they were very interested in seeing my bass because it's a very beautiful French bass made in 1840 by Jean-Baptiste Vuillaume. And even the cellists were looking at the bass, and I was looking at their basses, and they were just saying that how great and what a pleasure it was for them to do this music, because usually in the studios they get studio calls every day to play very run-of-the-mill music, which you know, they can read the LA Times to, and this was very special for them, and everybody in the orchestra thanked me afterwards. They said this was a really special musical moment for us.
Now, your children, you have like three daughters who are triplets and a son, and I think most of them play music now. Your son actually has a new CD,
yes.
Joshua Hayden, and I'm wondering if you did anything as a father to consciously encourage or discourage your children from playing music and from playing it professionally. And the reason why I ask about discouraging is I know that there are plenty of people in music who wouldn't want to see their children become professional musicians because it's such a hard life.
I really never gave that a second thought. I wanted them to be happy and especially be excited about what they wanted to do in their lives. And, of course, their young lives were surrounded by all different kinds of music around the house. And when Josh, he was the oldest, he was born in 1968, and the triplets were born in 1971. And when he was like 3 and 4 and 5 years old, he was listening to the music that he really loved and also listening to jazz and classical music. And then when he started developing a need to play, he would call me into his room and he'd say, "Dad, you got to listen to that, this, and you got to listen to this." And he would play me the Meat Puppets, and he would play me Black Flag, and he would play me all these alternative bands. And I'd never heard any music like that before. And he really introduced me to new music, and I just encouraged him. And I encourage my daughters. They're all very gifted, Rachel, Petra, and Tanya. I'm so proud of them, and I think they're all innovators, and they happen to be my favorite musicians right now.
Bassist Charlie Hayden speaking with Terry Gross. His new CD with his Quartet West group is The Art of the Song. We'll hear more of their interview later in the show. Coming up, we meet Josh Hayden. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Hayden said his favorite musicians are his kids. Charlie's son Josh has his own performing career as a singer, songwriter, and bassist of the group Spain. Josh Hayden co-founded the group in 1993. After years of playing in a punk band, he decided to move to a softer, more acoustic sound. Spain has just released their second CD, She Haunts My Dreams. Before we get to Terry's interview with Josh Hayden, let's listen to a song off the CD. This is hoped and prayed.
In those days, I was all alone. I was all alone. In those days, I was all alone. I was all alone. I was all alone. Met a girl and I hoped and prayed that she wasn't the one. Met a girl and I hoped and prayed that she wasn't.
Josh Hayden singing from Spain's new CD, She Haunts My Dreams. You play the bass, as your father Charlie Hayden does. How did you end up playing it? I think a lot of people would have done their best to steer away from the instrument that their parents played.
Well, I think I did try, but it didn't work. I tried to play the guitar when I was, I don't know, 12, 13 years old, and I didn't really connect with it. I feel even now there's just too many strings on the guitar. I think it's too much for my brain to comprehend. Four strings is much simpler, and the strings are bigger, so they're more easily accessible. And, you know, it's actually very mysterious to me why I feel so close to the bass. The only thing I could say is that it must have been just inculcated into my brain from a very early age, listening to my father play bass, you know, watching him go through scales or, you know, writing songs in our old apartment in New York City when I was 1 year old, or, you know, very young. And I think that makes a really lasting impression. I think it made a really lasting impression on me. That's probably why I play bass, I think.
I'm wondering what it was like to grow up hearing Ornette Coleman's music, which I imagine you did when you were young. You know, for a lot of people, that jazz group which your father was in was so radical that it was hard to assimilate. But I'm wondering, when you grow up with it, does it seem radical or just like music?
It seemed both. It was both. I mean, I recognized at an early age that Ornette Coleman's music was different than anything else. And at the same time, I accepted it as being normal because I heard it so much. And I'm sure to many, many people, his music was very revolutionary. But to me, his music was some of the first music I ever heard. Ornette Coleman set a standard for me when I was probably before I was born. He set a standard for me. And so I know that his music is revolutionary, but to me, that's like a starting point.
When you started listening to your own music, what was it?
You mean when
you started buying records and listening to radio stations?
My father asked me, "Oh, what do you like?" I think the first thing I wanted was the soundtrack to Mission Impossible.
The Lalo Schifrin score.
And I still have the first record that I picked out for myself was, it was kind of like a K-Tel compilation called Sessions, and it was like a really commercial 60s pseudo-psychedelic music. But I don't know why I liked it. I just did. I don't know why I like the soundtrack to Mission Impossible either. I still like it, though.
Yeah, yeah. So do I, actually. I love a lot of those adventure and action and spy themes.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever record with your father?
I think so. I know we will. It's just a matter of timing. And the only thing that keeps it from happening is scheduling. Mm-hmm. And I'm positive that'll happen in the future. Sooner than later.
What do you think of his vocal on his new CD?
I like it. He's told me for years that he can't sing because he had polio when he was a little kid that affected his vocal cords, and he couldn't sing because of that. And I know that it was just an excuse, because I think his singing sounds fine. I think it sounds really good, and I'm glad he did it.
Well, Josh Hayden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bassist and singer Josh Hayden speaking with Terry Gross. His trio Spain has a new CD called She Haunts My Dreams. We'll hear more from Josh's father, Charlie Hayden, in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine, exploring what life will be like in the next century with a new series next month, Visions 21. Interactive form is now available online, time.com. Additional support from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of Arms and the Woman by Reginald Hill, the new mystery featuring investigators D.L. and Pasco. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember jazz musician Art Farmer, who died Monday at the age of 71. And we continue our conversation with Charlie Hayden. On his new CD, The Art of the Song, he sings for the first time since he was a child when he sang with his family's country group. He'll tell us why.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, back with more of Terry's interview with jazz bassist Charlie Hayden. Since 1986, his group Quartet West has performed music paying tribute to hard-boiled fiction and film noir. The new Quartet West album is The Art of the Song, and it's the first time Hayden has ever sung on one of his CDs.
Well, I want to get to your vocal on your new CD. Your new CD is called The Art of the Song, and you chose two of your favorite singers to do most of the performances, Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson. But the last track is you singing, and you, as a rule, don't sing on your CDs. I think this is your first recorded performance outside of the years when you sang with your family. When you were a child, your family had a country group and used to sing on the radio. So tell us the story about how you decided to sing on your own CD.
I stopped singing on our show when I was 15. I developed bulbar polio, and it paralyzed my vocal cords. And eventually, you know, I got my vocal cords back, but I lost the range in my voice. And I used to sing every day on our radio show from the time I was 2 until I was 15. And after that occurrence, I kind of focused all my musical melody energy into my playing. I just started playing the bass and playing along with records around where we were living in Springfield, Missouri. And then when I moved to L.A., playing, you know, seeking out the great musicians. And I never really thought about singing again after that. And I didn't even sing in the shower. You know, I it wasn't that I was afraid to. It was just like it was over, you know, for me. And so recently some people have been talking about, you know, you used to sing, how come you don't sing anymore or sing? You know, Ruth, my wife, who's a singer, has said, you know, why don't you sing? And then actually one day I was on your show a while ago, and we were talking about Now Is the Hour, and you asked me to sing it, and I was very reluctant, and I couldn't believe that you asked me, and I finally gave in and sang, and you called back later and said that you thought it was great and that I should sing sometime on one of my records. And I said, well, thanks for the compliment, Terry. It was kind of humorous to me, and I never really took it seriously until we started planning this record. And I was going through music, and I ran across some of our music from our radio show with my family back in the 40s, and I saw this song called The Wayfaring Stranger that my mom used to sing on our show, and I remembered how beautiful it was. And then I was going through some LPs and CDs, and I found this recording of Joe Stafford singing folk music, and one of the songs on the album was The Wayfaring Stranger, and I listened to it, and it reminded me of how beautiful the song was. And so I thought about doing it on the record instrumentally, and then I thought, you know, this isn't a song for Shirley or Bill to sing, but it should really be sung because the words are so beautiful. Because I remembered when my mom sang it. And so I said, well, the only way it could be sung is if I sing it. And I thought, you know, oh my goodness, that's not going to work. And Alan was over, and I played it for him. I said, what do you think of this? And he said, wow, that is really beautiful. I said, what would you think if I tried to sing it? And he said, wow. He said, that'd be different. And I said, so.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I said, well, you know, and I even, I called Jean-Philippe Allard, our executive producer in Paris, and I said, you know, I might sing on this record. And there was a big silence. And he said, pardon? I said, I might sing. And another long silence, pardon? I said, anyway, I told Alan, I said, write the arrangement as if somebody's going to sing it. And if I don't make it, I'll play it on the bass, you know. So he wrote the arrangement. I didn't practice the song, you know, a couple of times, you know, I was a little nervous. Around the house, I kind of sang the melody at home just to go through it, just to make sure that I could actually sing, you know. I didn't want to do it too much because, you know, I didn't want to get my mindset in like, oh, I'm a singer and I've got to sing this like a singer and it's got to be perfect. Because I really believe singers, and that's why I love Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson so much, is that they sing the way they speak. I mean, when they stop speaking and start to sing, they don't change their voice the way they say their words or anything about what they're doing in any way. They just, it's just natural and honest, and that's why they're such great singers. And, you know, a lot of singers now, and even in the past, as soon as they began to sing, they everything changes, it's all of a sudden somebody else, you know. And so I didn't want to make myself nervous, so we got into the studio, and I just got up to the microphone, and they started to play it, and I sang. And Shirley Horn came in to me, and she said, "You got to put this on the record." And I said, "Are you really serious?" She said, "Yes." And she said, "Some of those string players out there are in tears." I said, "Well, that's probably because it's so bad, you know." She said, So I put it on the record, and I hope people like it. It's not doing it as a singer; it's doing it to tell a story of, you know, where I come from. And
well, I really love this, and I'm so glad that you went through with singing it and listening to it. I was wondering, you know, knowing that you knew this song as a kid and that your mother sang it. When you were a child, what did the words mean to you? The song is just filled with metaphors about death, you know, crossing over the River Jordan. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home to see my father. What did you get about that? And was it a frightening song to you, thinking about death, or what?
No, it actually is a very soothing song. It's just the opposite of me. It's a song about life.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a very funny thing that my mom told me once when I was 4 years old. She was working around we lived on a farm outside Springfield, Missouri, and she was working around the house, and all of a sudden she heard me screaming in the living room, and she thought, you know, I'd done something horrible had happened to me. She ran in the living room. She said, "Charlie, what's wrong?" And I looked up at her, and I said, "I'm going to die." And she said, "What in the world are you talking about?" And she said, "You're thinking about..." She said, "You don't have..." She was like cracking up, you know, so... I always have this deep need for the beauty of life, the reason for life, and the preciousness of life, you know, and how precious every moment is that we're alive, and we should really do everything that we can to enhance this life that we have and this planet that we live on, and this song just evokes that to me.
What happened to you that day? What were you thinking about that made you think, "I'm going
to
die"?
I think somebody close to us had just died and they had a funeral, and I was thinking about, oh God, someday that's going to happen to me, you know, and here I am 4 years old and I start screaming.
Now, there's a picture of you as a child performing, well, in a picture with your family from the days that you performed, and you look really young in it, maybe 4 years old, 5 years old, and you're wearing like a red neckerchief and cowboy boots. Is that part
right?
of your image on stage?
Back then, they called me Cowboy Charlie, and and I didn't, you know, always wear a cowboy suit. But for that picture, I mean, we went to the studio every day, and I just wore everyday clothes. But that was a special pose picture. But we were on different shows. My parents were on the Grand Ole Opry. That was before I was born, and then later on, we did a network show from Springfield called Corns a Crackin', where all of the Nashville people came up to Springfield and appeared on the show. And we got to know real close the Carter family, and Roy Acuff and people like that were our friends. And I feel very lucky that I was able to know all those great musicians. It really was a big influence on my musical life. But now I remember what I said when my mother came running into the... What I said was, "I don't want to die."
Oh.
It wasn't that I'm dying. I said, "I don't want to die." And she said, "Jesus, Charlie." Anyway.
Well, before we hear Poor Wayfaring Stranger, I'm wondering if you think you'll be performing this song in front of audiences.
The Wayfaring Stranger?
Yeah.
That's the first time I thought of it. I really don't... I don't know.
Are you shy about it? Shy about singing in a way that you're not about playing bass?
Probably, because I don't... That's the first time I've sung in like 45 years, so mm-hmm. I'm very shy about it, and I always want to do everything the best I can possibly do, and I play every day, you know, but I don't sing every day, so that would go into my feelings about it.
Right. Well, I do hope you sing more, and
well,
I want to thank you for talking with us, and why don't we end with your recording of The Wayfaring Stranger from your new CD, The Art of Song, and my guest has been Charlie Hayden. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Terry. I am a poor wayfaring stranger, a wandering through this world of woe, and there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going home to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over clouds will gather round me. I know my way is rough and steep, but golden fields lie out before me, where men said she'd meet me when I come. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over.
Charlie Hayden from his new CD with the Quartet West called The Art of the Song. Coming up, we remember jazz musician Art Farmer. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this week, jazz musician Art Farmer died of cardiac arrest at the age of 71. Jazz critic Whitney Balliot described Farmer as a gently melodic player whose style is spare, lyrical, logical. Farmer came of age just in time to play with the big bands before many of them were wiped out by post-war musical and economic changes. At the age of 16, he and his brother moved from Phoenix to Los Angeles to play music. But he established his name in the late 50s, playing bop and ballads in small groups. Farmer moved to Vienna in 1968, but returned to the States frequently to perform. Earlier this year, Farmer was named one of the three American Jazz Masters of 1999 by the National Endowment for the Arts. Terry Gross spoke with Art Farmer in 1987. Let's start with an early recording of Farmer's. This is The Very Thought of You, recorded in 1958.
To say, I think your ballad playing is really just exquisite.
Thank you.
And I wonder how you sort of gravitating to ballads, because it's something really that a lot of bop players either don't do or don't do very well.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me like you have a chance to think when you're playing a ballad. That fast tempo is not pulling you along, so you can take time and really sort of sculpture the note just the way you want to get it. You know, you don't have to move on to the next thing until you're exactly ready to do it. And there must be some other reason than that, but I really can't think of what it is right now. I like to hear ballads played.
Me too.
I like to hear someone who can play one well. And at the time that I came up, well, the criterion of how good a player was how good he could play a ballad. You know, regardless of how much he was into with the fast stuff or, you know, you take a guy like John Coltrane, for instance. Well, it's always, yes, but can he play a ballad? And yes, John Coltrane can play a ballad. And Charlie Parker, yes, but can he play a ballad? Yes, Charlie Parker could play a ballad, you know. That's how they were judged by the older guys, you know. That's where you take your hat off.
Gee, you know, I'm almost surprised to hear that, because I assume that that people would be really showing off how fast they could play a lick.
No, the older guys say, look, you have to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell a story, paint a picture. And even Dizzy says that, you know, that's the whole thing.
You mentioned before that when you and your brother moved to Los Angeles, you met a lot of musicians there like Charlie Parker, Eric Dolphy, Hampton Hawes. Were they very influential to you? Because suddenly you had peers who were playing jazz. You were pretty isolated in Phoenix, and it doesn't sound like there was much of a jazz scene or a jazz community.
No, we were all influenced actually by the same. We were influenced by the people who had already found their thing. You know, like Bird and Miles and Dizzy. Those were the people that were influenced. Bud Powell and Monk and people like that. They'd already found their way, and they were the ones that were influencing us. And we were at that time we weren't really thinking about trying to find our own thing. We were just trying to play, more or less trying to imitate them at that particular time.
Did that work for you? At one point did you start thinking about finding your own voice?
Well, it seems like a gradual thing happened where you just sort of segue into your own voice. You don't just one day, at least when I say you, I mean me. I didn't just one day wake up and say, well, that's it, I'm going to go for myself. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just like over a period of time, you'd get an idea of, well, do this or do that, you know, and then it would wind up to be somewhere you can always see where the, in hindsight, you can see where little, there were little deviations. Because when I first started, when I was first influenced as a jazz player, it was in, my main influences were Fats Navarro and Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie. And I would take from all of them. But I was, eventually I was able to add a note here and there.
Did you like them personally?
Yeah, sure. I liked all three of them, and I still do.
Didn't Miles Davis used to rent your horn?
Yeah, he used to rent it, yeah.
Wait, was his in Hawk?
Yeah. At one time he didn't have a horn, or he couldn't get to his horn, so he would rent mine, and he would rent there used to be another guy. I can't remember his name right now. He used to use his horn. So a guy used to work for Prestige. But he would come by and want to take my horn, so I would go with him, you know, just for safety.
What would happen if you and Miles Davis both had a gig on the same night?
Oh, well, that happened, and he expected me to cancel my gig.
So you had to tell him no?
I told him that I wasn't in the horn rent business, you know, but he's never at a loss for words. He really insisted. He said, look, man, I'm paying you for the horn. I said, yeah, but, you know, that's not my business. I want to play, too. You know, so you would think that he would say, yeah, well, I understand, sure. He said, man, I didn't know you were like that.
Jazz musician Art Farmer speaking with Terry Gross from a 1987 interview. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We continue Terry's interview with jazz musician Art Farmer, recorded in 1987. He died earlier this week.
When you were starting out in New York, you knew Lester Young there, right?
Yes.
He had this, I mean, not that I've ever heard him speak, but I've certainly read about it, and he had this kind of hip language of his own that he would use. Would you ever feel almost square by comparison because he was such the consummate hipster?
No, well, you see, in the environment, what would be called the jazz environment, there were ways of us talking to each other that so no one would know what we were talking about, for one reason or the other, with whatever there might be something that people shouldn't know what we were talking about, or maybe some things if it was money. Well, then I remember working with one band where the money was so little, we didn't want people to know what it was, you know. So if you ask someone, well, how much are we making tonight? If it was $20, which it wasn't, then they wouldn't say 20. They would say line 20. So if someone hears that, they would say, well, line 20. Well, that could mean like maybe that means 200 or 40 or who knows, you know. Well, but that was just one example. But Lester Young, he really carried out everything he said was like that. He never left that hardly. When he was just talking to us, he had his own way of talking, and we just had to figure out what he meant. If he said one lung, well, that would mean one course. You know, after you've been there for one night or two, you know his words, half a lung, George Washington. If he says yetis, well, then that means leave it alone.
I guess you couldn't very well say What exactly does that mean, Lester?
Well, that wouldn't be too hip, you know? You just sort of let it sink in.
For over 20 years now, your instrument has really been flugelhorn, which is subtly different from a trumpet in ways I will ask you to explain.
Well, it has a bigger sound. My first love is still the trumpet, but the sound that I was trying to get on the trumpet, I can get it more consistently on the flugelhorn. And even regardless of what note you play, it starts with the sound. And if I'm not satisfied with the sound that I hear in my own ears, then it sort of has a way of blocking my thinking. So I can't improvise that fluently unless I'm satisfied with the first sound. So I prefer to play the flugelhorn for improvisation. However, if I'm working with a big band in the trumpet section, then I take the trumpet out.
I noticed before that you were fidgeting with a mouthpiece.
Oh, yeah.
Do you keep one in your pocket all the time?
No, but this one, I don't leave it any place because the mouthpiece is the part that's closest to you and is irreplaceable. You can always find a horn. I would hate to lose the horn, but I would hate twice as much to lose the mouthpiece.
It sounds really odd considering the mouthpiece is this little yeah. thing and the horn is like the really expensive
yeah,
yeah,
that
part
reminds
of the instrument.
That's the story. Like Nat Adderley was in New York. He used to live in New York, and one night he got robbed, and the people took his horn. You know, he robbed on the street. They took his horn, took all of his money, and he told the guy, he said, "Look, man, look, may I please ask you if you would just give me my mouthpiece?" He said, "I've been playing that mouthpiece ever since I've been playing. If you would please just give me the mouthpiece." And this guy said, "What? You want the mouthpiece? Well, oh, you want that old thing? Oh, take it. That ain't nothing. You can have it."
Sorry.
He was so glad to get it. He said, "You can take the money, take the horn, but just give me the mouthpiece." Well, that's the way I feel, you know.
Art Farmer, it's really just been so great to meet you. Thank you very
Thank
much
you.
For coming today.
Thank you, Terry.
Art Farmer speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. Farmer died earlier this week. He was 71. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui Westman, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Bob Purdick is our engineer. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of the Breast Cancer Prevention Diet, the powerful foods, supplements, and drugs that combat breast cancer by Dr. Bob Arnott, in paperback wherever books are sold. And from Crown, publishers of the new book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals, by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with editor Robert McCrum and his wife Sarah Lyle. McCrum was 42 and newly married when he suffered a stroke. His memoir about his recovery is now out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.